Well, expand on the original BioShock story, Jordan.
Well, I guess a few different ways. Beyond what we've just sort of covered, the focus here is on choice, in that the player is defined by the moment in which he is granted free will this time around, very much in contrast to the original. Unlike other Big Daddies, Delta is not enslaved to the city, and is able to make a number of sort of ethical decisions which shape the outcome of the plot in a way that wasn't possible in the original. Andrew Ryan is now dead, and in his place, in that power vacuum, Dr. Sophia Lamb has sort of seized control. She is a very different thinker, kind of based on John Stuart Mill and Karl Marx, and she is unwilling to allow any individual to compromise her plans.
Okay, so here's the question for Zach. What elements from BioShock were most important to keep, and what were the aspects that you most wanted to improve upon?
Well, the big stuff that we obviously wanted to keep from BioShock from a gameplay perspective was the focus on sort of player choice and getting to kind of roll your own shooter and play the game that you wanted to play, and the diversity of that tool set, as well as obviously some of the elements Jordan touched on with the deep story, with the philosophical underpinnings, and actual sort of moral choice. From a gameplay perspective, the big things that we were trying to improve was a lot of that core gameplay, and make it more accessible to people in the way that you could combine your weapons and plasmids at the same time. So that's where we went down the dual-wielding route, that you can use them much more fluidly. And that also we wanted to deepen the growth mechanics of the game. You now can upgrade all of your plasmids by 3 levels. They have new functionality as you go through the game. The tonics are a lot more open-ended. And we also wanted to grow the ecology of the world. You know, BioShock 1 had the great Big Daddies and Little Sisters dynamic, and we wanted to sort of expand upon that idea of this world having its own sort of self-sufficient system, which is part of where the Big Sisters who live at the top of that atom ecology kind of came from. So a lot of it was improving on aspects that were already there, or finding a way to make them more accessible and friendly to a wider audience.
Okay, so here's a question going back to Jordan. How are the actions of the protagonist in BioShock reflected in BioShock 2?
Well, given that in many ways our thesis in BioShock 2 has to do with player choice, we wanted to respect anything that the player might have decided in the original game. So the knowns are that the Little Sisters are now gone, whether they were saved by Jack or by Tenenbaum, who would have only managed to rescue the survivors of Jack's rampage. And the Andrew Ryan, of course, has fallen, and that Jack eventually left Rapture, and so this massive power vacuum opened up, and that is where Sophia Lamb kind of comes in. There is a fierce religious debate among the Splicers about the sort of messianic acts performed by the protagonist of the first game, and you hear them kind of discussing that as you play.
So will players ever know the true origins of Subject D in BioShock 2, or does it solely rely on what happens from the point after he is awakened?
Suffice it to say, the story is mystery-driven. One of the central questions that people always ask is, who am I? We're certainly mindful of that, although I would say that because the central conflict of the story is sort of a family triangle in many ways, there is more to offer than just that question in terms of the mystery that unfolds towards the end.
So this is a good question for Hogarth. Are we going to see any returning characters from BioShock? If so, can you say who will be back?
Definitely Tenenbaum is a character that you actually see in BioShock 2, who was also in BioShock 1. But I think on kind of a more abstract level, I guess, Rapture, since you're going back to Rapture, and Rapture is basically Ryan's legacy, the kind of crumbling, sad legacy of Andrew Ryan, you'll see like kind of Andrew Ryan's messages and Andrew Ryan's ideals around the game. So he's still part of the game as a character. And a lot of people said Rapture sort of was the character of it, you know, on its own. But I think that more embodies Ryan than anything else. So you'll see Tenenbaum as an actual person, but Ryan as a character, I guess he still plays a big part in BioShock 2.
Okay. Let's see. Here's a question for Jordan. After surviving the first jaunt through Rapture, I grew very attached to Jack Ryan. Why did you guys choose not to bring him back as the main protagonist?
Well, his arc resolves in the original game in a satisfying way, and it is very much an ending to his tale. He either becomes kind of a figure of conquest or one of redemption. And we absolutely needed to allow for that story to come to its conclusion and not to try and overwrite it with a canonical ending. Beyond that, we also felt like in a sequel, playing a Big Daddy offered a very different perspective, not just narratively, but within the gameplay.
So on going along the Andrew Ryan theme, I found Andrew Ryan to be an incredibly intriguing character. Does his objectivist philosophy still hold weight on Rapture, or has the passage of time and presence of Sophia Lam erased his legacy?
Sophia Lam has certainly made her attempt to blot him out, although I'll give you a little more specific example since Hoagie covered some of that. There was a level early on called Ryan Amusements where you see the philosophy of Andrew Ryan from a child's eye view, very much a kind of propaganda indoctrination park. And so you absolutely have a lot of the sort of old fire and brimstone that you got from Ryan, but from the point of view of one of Rapture's native children.
So going back to Zach, why are you playing as a Big Daddy this time, and what's his purpose in Bioshock 2?
Yeah, playing as a Big Daddy is actually one of the first things that we decided on the project. Making a Bioshock 2 is really challenging. We were looking at ways that we could kind of reevaluate a lot of things about the gameplay, and the change of protagonist was one of the best hooks into that. And knowing that you played at a Big Daddy, we got to re-examine how would the weapons work, how would the character feel, how would the balance of combat be, and it really was a good way for us to bring a fresh perspective to all the gameplay of Bioshock. Beyond that, it was something that was just hugely requested by fans and people who played the first game. It was something you kind of got a glimpse of at the end of Bioshock 1 in a way that made people really want to have, you know, that drill and the rivet gun and all the cool things that you expected from Bioshock 1. And we kind of wanted to deliver on that experience. In terms of his purpose, Jordan sort of covers some of that in the story conversation. He's really out in search of his original little sister, so he has a much more personal stake and personal ties to Rapture itself.
So then on the Big Daddy theme, how does this prototype differ from the one in the original Bioshock?
The original Big Daddies, the Bouncer and the Rosie, they're very slow, lumbering powerhouses, and it was something for sort of, you know, the length of a single-player game. We knew that while that level of power was really seductive to people, we knew that we couldn't do an entire game where you were sort of trudging around at the slow, lumbering pace of those Big Daddy characters. So, you know, he's a lot more agile than the classic Big Daddies. He obviously can use plasmids, a greater range of weapon, but, you know, the big difference, of course, is that he has free will, and he's able to make his own choices and some really weighty moral choices as the story goes along as well.
So another question for you, Zach, on the Big Daddy front. As a fleshy human, Big Daddy fights were often a visceral, adrenaline-pumping affair. The strategy and risk required in taking one of these behemoths down became a hallmark experience for the game. So as a Big Daddy, will such encounters remain as challenging and rewarding as before?
That's certainly our goal. I mean, as with all things Rapture, we never can quite get to the same impact of your first experience. The first time you went toe-to-toe with a Big Daddy in the medical pavilion in Bioshock 1 was, you know, just shocking and terrifying. But we want to get we have a lot more of that with when you fight the Big Sisters. The Big Daddies are still immensely challenging for you, and we have a new Big Daddy type, the Rumbler, who is a lot more of an even match for you. So they're still meant to be incredibly difficult fights that you have to plan in advance for. You may get knocked down a few times and have to replan your strategy. It's not meant to be an even battle most of the time.
Okay, so this is a question for Jordan, but still on the Big Daddy lines. This is a question I really wanted to ask. Who is actually in the Big Daddy suits?
So the first game states outright that they are humans who were abducted from the city of Rapture and augmented heavily with Adam and sort of grafted to diving suits. Beyond that, the story of the protagonist of Bioshock 2 is more of a mystery, and we won't spoil that one.
Okay, so let's see. I think this question. We know Big Daddy's played a pivotal protecting role in Bioshock 1. We're now introduced to the Big Sisters. Were they in Bioshock 1?
Is the question, where were they?
Oh, where were they? Sorry. Where were they in Bioshock 1?
The sisters are actually grown-up little sisters. There was a source of, suffice it to say, hidden little sisters in Rapture. Only a few who sort of escaped the great cult. And those have grown up and become physically unstable as the atom that they've been ingesting for years and years and years has begun to manifest. So that's really where they were. They were gathering from corpses.
So the big this is a question back to Zach. The Big Sister's design is amazing. What inspirations did you draw upon to create them? Any unique features or design decisions you would like to point out?
I mean, the obvious touchstone for the Big Sister design is, of course, the Big Daddies and the sort of classic diving suit motifs. But, you know, whereas the Big Daddies have this sort of, you know, kindly old man, weary, lumbering appeal to them, the Big Sisters were sort of more meant to embody kind of an awkward adolescent phase and kind of that point of childhood, because since they are growing up Big Sisters where you're a little larger than your body is sort of used to dealing with. And so they're very lithe, they're a little awkward in their posing, and, you know, they have leg braces, but they're still very graceful in this kind of awkwardness. And beyond that, we tried to bring sort of a softer edge and have some of those more, you know, little girl feelings, because these are little sisters who have grown up a little too fast. And so some of the smaller details that you may not notice during gameplay are things like there's little ribbons on the basket that she uses to carry the little sisters. There's small childlike drawings on her tank. And there are some more, you know, small personal details in the character design that if you sort of stop and look at it, you'll notice.
So what role will the little sisters play in BioShock 2?
Little Sisters, I mean, beyond being really pivotal for the overall plot of the game, your goal is to track down your original little sister. From a gameplay perspective, they both do what they did in BioShock 1. They're, you know, accompanying Big Daddies, going around and gathering from corpses. But they also supply sort of one of the big new gameplay additions for BioShock 2, which is adoption. You know, you're a Big Daddy yourself, so that when you fight a Big Daddy, you can actually adopt the little sister and form kind of a partnership, and she'll lead you to bodies around Rapture that have Adam in them, and it becomes a kind of a opt-in dynamic ambush scenario where you place her down on an Adam-filled corpse and you have to protect her while she's gathering. And it leads to a different kind of gameplay dynamic, still very optional, and just the way that the Big Daddies were kind of optional boss fights. These are sort of optional sieges, but they lead to sort of a different lateral thinking on how you use your tools and your defenses. And you can partner up with them over the course of the game, and it helps build that Big Daddy-Little Sister relationship that we knew was part of the overall Big Daddy fantasy.
So as a dad with this is a quick question for Jordan. As a dad with a young daughter, I could not bring myself to kill any of the little sisters in the first game, which ultimately didn't affect the outcome of the game for me and, of course, led to the happy ending. Will the moral choices in BioShock 2 require the player to make the unpleasant, awful choices that the first one offered but never actually required?
I think it would undermine the value of a moral choice to force one or the other sort of path. In the sense that the father relationship with the little sisters, although twisted, in that both people involved in the pair have been subject to this gruesome conditioning, is still kind of primal and sad and in some ways uplifting, depending on how you treat them. So you are still called upon to make those choices, but you are not forced to mistreat them. And in fact, you know, what you do with that trust is part of how your choices inform the ending of the game.
So here's a question for Zach. Have you made the choice of whether or not to harvest the little sisters any harder this time around? In the first game, we didn't feel that you lost out on enough by saving them to make it a difficult choice. You could only become as powerful regardless of whether you saved or harvested them.
That's something that has been a common criticism of the first game, and it was something we tried to make those choices around the little sister a little bit more gray. It's both harder to be good and more rewarding to be really, truly evil with the little sisters in BioShock 2. If you just straight up save the little sisters and never engage in the adoption gameplay, you are going to be starved for Adam for most of the entire game. On the other hand, if you are as terrible a person as you possibly can and you go around and you adopt and you partner up with the little sisters and then you harvest them later, you're going to be really, really flush. But there's a middle ground, and if you are the kind of player who really wants to work for it and gather for Adam from bodies and save little sisters, you can keep pace with the selfish player who just harvests them outright, but you're going to be doing a whole lot more work for it. And sort of as those battles get more difficult as the game goes on, it's a lot more alluring to just sort of cash in a little sister immediately by harvesting your and get that quick reward rather than doing the long, hard work of gathering from bodies. So we're hoping that gameplay choice is actually a little bit more reflective of kind of the choices that go on in your head when you're trying to deal with complex moral situations.
Hey, Jordan, the original BioShock game presented gamers with a new chilling environment and story. Do you feel the shock, in quotes, value is still in BioShock 2?
I think that's kind of a two-parter. On the one hand, you know, the setting of Rapture will never be as new as it was in the first game, and I think trying to chase that would have been sort of folly on many levels. That said, there are a significant number of new surprises. The second part of that question has to do with twists, and we definitely don't follow the same template as the original game, which is sort of the usual suspect, Sixth Sense kind of narrative model. We're targeting something very different, which is kind of all about reflecting things you personally have done. Whether or not we're successful, you know, we'll kind of leave up to the individual to judge. But so far, the response has been very positive to especially the way that the game plays out at the end.
Okay, here's some questions for Hogarth. And in terms of environment, what percentage of the areas in BioShock 2 are areas we visited in the first game, and what percent are brand new?
They're actually all brand new in BioShock 2. And in fact, we toyed with the idea of letting you explore part of Fort Frolic from the original BioShock that was going to be totally flooded. But actually, I'm talking about the single player game right now. Actually, probably Matt could answer this from a multiplayer perspective because the answer is a little bit different. But anyway, we toyed with the idea of letting you explore flooded Fort Frolic, and we decided that we didn't feel like it just wasn't working very well. It wasn't holding up to our rigorous standards. And we really, part of going back to Rapture for us as developers was that we felt like there were a lot of unique areas that we imagined in the city that you hadn't seen playing the first game. And so we wanted to kind of maximize that exploration for players.
And so is BioShock 2 going to have the same art style as the first one?
It's going to have the same style. You're seeing entirely new environments and you're meeting new characters and stuff like that. So there are new manifestations of that style, but it's still, you know, we wanted it to feel like Rapture. So we felt like there was, you know, reinventing the actual artistic style was going to be contrary to our original goal. And just stepping back a minute, Chase, I don't know if you want to let Matt talk a little bit about the multiplayer environments, because there are environments in multiplayer that players get to explore that are reimaginings of spaces from the original BioShock.
Yeah, sure. I mean, we also will be touching upon the whole multiplayer in depth later on in the call, but if he wants to weigh in on that topic, that would be great. Matt?
Okay, cool.
Yeah, well, I guess, as Hoagie said, there were some really fantastic areas, and we just kind of tried to give multiplayer or people playing the multiplayer game, you know, perhaps a different take on those areas, or, you know, see different areas that they might not have explored. But there's definitely areas within the multiplayer environments and maps that you'll recognize for, you know, what they were in the first game, but they're going to look different. You're going to experience them a little bit differently. But we really played on the strong environments that the guys in the first game made, and just kind of tweaked them a bit.
So here's a question for Zach. Will Vita Chambers be utilized differently compared to the first game?
In a couple of key ways. I mean, the most important one is that unlike BioShock 1, which had this functionality kind of added in after launch, you can turn them off immediately. When you first start the game, you can decide you never want to use Vita Chambers at all. If that's the kind of gamer that you are and you want that level of challenge. The other big key difference that we did specifically for Big Daddies, if you die, their little sister will start to heal them after the battle. And so they will start to sort of heal back up to their full strength, which means specifically against the Big Daddies, you can't really do the generous strategy that was available in the first game where you could, you know, go up to a Big Daddy, hit him four times with your wrench, die again, do that again and again. You kind of have to be able to get a Big Daddy all in one go, which makes it a lot more focused on player planning and being able to take him down all at once.
So here's another one for you, Zach. You can explore the ocean floor, correct? Without spoilers or advantages or added bonuses, what advantages or added bonuses is there for gamers to look forward to?
The big advantage is, of course, being able to see Rapture from the outside from the first time, and that was sort of what was compelling about it to us is, you know, one, being able to see this gorgeous, amazing city from a different perspective, and the kind of pacing differentiation that it gives you over the course of the game, because Rapture from the inside is such a dangerous, tense place, and so many people played the first game when we talked to them, you know, talked about how they never felt safe and never got to really, you know, enjoy the beauty of the environment. Beyond that, you know, there's some exploration value of the outside areas, and hopefully it's not too big of a spoiler, you actually can find some of the original atom slugs out in their natural habitat and use that to sort of grow your character a little bit more, and those are hidden in some of the outdoor spaces as well.
So Jordan, a philosophy question for you. The philosophy of individualism was obviously a huge part of the first title. With the sequel seemingly going in a completely opposite philosophical direction, how early on in development was the theme determined, and what were the deciding factors to take that approach?
Very early. So shortly after deciding that the kind of father-daughter bond would be central to the story, there became the obvious question of, well, what would make for a meaningful antagonist to that? And somebody who's trying to subvert the traditional definition of family through a heavily altruistic filter, sort of for the common good above the individual loyalty, was sort of naturally followed, and that's how Sophia Lam was born. As I previously mentioned, you know, she's based on several altruistic thinkers and also the kind of intellectual progeny of Richard Dawkins.
Okay, so here's the one for Hoagie. Based on what's been released, it seems like you are giving the Splicers more personality and screen time. Is the whole experience going to be less about the isolation and dreaded nothingness of an underwater city and more about its inhabitants and the constant threat of attack?
I think that, yeah, there's a couple of answers to that. The first one is that not only is the frequency of encounter a little bit greater, I think, in BioShock 2 as a player encountering Splicers, but also there are characters now that you get to meet in Rapture who are genuine, kind of normal human inhabitants who aren't spliced up murderous lunatics. So I think I think we did sort of make a decision at the beginning of the game when we were brainstorming about it, that we did want it to be a little bit less about being isolated, because we had a lot of people who responded to the first game. I mean, that was one of the great things about the first game, but we had a lot of people who said, you know, it's sort of weird that I walk around in the city and all I see are these, like, murdering Splicers all the time. Aren't there any other normal people like me who live down here? And so we did do that in BioShock 2. There are a handful of characters that you meet who are pretty important to the progress of the narrative in BioShock 2, and I think they really do help make it feel a little bit less lonely.
So, Zach, how has the AI improved? Will we see traps set by Splicers or packs of Splicers that work together to try and take down a Big Daddy?
You'll definitely see some of those ambushes over the course of the game. We did a lot of small buildup on the AI. They're a lot smarter than they were in BioShock 1. Splicers can use cover. They all can throw grenades. They're a lot more mobile. They're able to, you know, sort of jump down and jump up from ledges. And beyond that, we were really trying to get a larger diversity in the AI. And so we have things like the Brute Splicer, who's, you know, this big, beefy, hulking guy who can throw large blocks of concrete and go toe-to-toe with a Big Daddy like the player. And then the Spider Splicers are further differentiated, and they can, you know, climb on walls and ceilings, and they're a lot more elongated, and just have more overall diversity in kind of their behavior set and the looks of them, rather than just sort of the more human-like Splicers that you saw in BioShock 1.
Jordan, here's a question that I'm sure all gamers would like to confirm. Will BioShock 2 have a better final boss than the first one?
Actually, we sort of see the final boss of the original game as one of the things that in general, BioShock doesn't do well. So without spoiling the ending, suffice it to say we've taken a very different approach.
Fair enough. Zach, from a combat perspective, what new additions have been made to BioShock 2?
Lots. At the most basic level, you know, we added the dual wielding, so you no longer have to switch between your weapons and plasmids. And that was pretty transformational for the BioShock combat experience, because it allows you to sort of combine all of your powers and weapons much more fluidly and on the fly, and so it's much easier to make the kind of creative combinations that we're trying to encourage the player to do. At a more basic level, we basically have revamped every single weapon and every single plasmid in the game. A lot of them will seem familiar from BioShock 1, but the way that they grow and the functionality that they have has been changed really substantially. Beyond that, we also revamped both the hacking and the research system to sort of interrupt the combat experience a lot less. We tried to make it all sort of part of one sort of very immediate, fluid combat experience, and you weren't kind of switching into playing a mini game and then switching into taking pictures, and then it all fit together into one kind of flow for players.
So the original BioShock, this is also for you, Zach, the original BioShock had the rather odd ability to divide gamers over the difficulty. Some felt it was too hard, while others felt it was too easy. As developers, how do you address such varied feedback on the difficulty level? Obviously, all games should provide a challenge, but are you constantly aware of the risks involved in making a game a little too tough, or at the opposite end of the scale, too straightforward?
that's always kind of a danger in a game where you have a lot of character growth and a lot of, you know, optional systems. You know, people who invest deeply in those are probably, you know, more hardcore people anyway, and they're going to get more of those bonuses and perks that make the game easier. And people who kind of gloss over that stuff or they're not interested are going to have a harder experience. This is actually somewhere where playing as a big daddy really worked to our advantage. BioShock 1, the balance for Jack, for that character, was he was very fragile. He could go down relatively quickly, and if you kind of weren't paying attention, a splicer could just sort of blindside you and take you out. With playing as a big daddy, we knew one of people's expectations would be, you know, that you're a little bit more durable. So we were able to sort of recalibrate that combat experience into a little more survivability for the player. And beyond that, we focused on some AI improvements to get them to allow a little bit more space. So guys will sort of break off every once in a while, allow you to catch your breath, so that, you know, even players of all skill levels have a chance to sort of think on the fly. Beyond that, the changes I talked about before with the combat system of trying to put fewer stumbling blocks between you and your tools were something that made it easier for a more diverse audience to sort of come to grips with how crazy the BioShock toolset can be. And then beyond that, you know, we have varying difficulty levels, and we encourage people to sort of up the difficulty level if they're doing very, very well, or perhaps drop it if they're doing very, very badly. And we do a lot of internal playtesting against these goals, and we get people from all walks of life, you know, hardcore gamers and just people who don't really know how to play shooters at all, to play the game, and we try to make sure that the difficulty levels are balanced appropriately for those audiences.
So here's a personal question for you. Playing as Big Daddy this time, what new weapons and changes to the combat system were made, or weapons that the team is proud of?
Yeah, I mean, I can talk about a couple of the ones that I know were big favorites on our side. I mean, number one was the drill. Everybody, you know, knowing you played as a big daddy was sort of one of the first questions everybody asked of, like, hey, are we going to do a drill? I want a drill. Bouncer has a drill. And so that was something that we put in, and we knew it had to be a little bit more robust than your standard sort of, you know, bash and whack wrench from BioShock 1. And we spent a lot of time iterating on that and working on the upgrades and all the rest of it. And it really became a core tool that's just really fun and really visceral and rewarding to use. So we're all really proud of that. Other things on the gameplay side was some of the cool tools that we have now for more sort of tactical and defensive gameplay. Obviously, as a big daddy and with the adoption, you're doing a lot more of kind of defending spots against splicers. And so we were able to grow a lot of the weapons in kind of that direction and supply some things that encourage kind of player planning at different levels. And so we have trap rivets that you can shoot out of the rivet gun and kind of spam out very quickly to defend an area, or you can now charge your traps up and combine your plasmids by making a cyclone trap charged with fire. Or things like mini turrets that allow you to create your own defensive turrets anywhere on the fly. And a lot of the way those tools combine into these defensive scenarios is something I think that we're all pretty happy with the results on.
So this is a good question for Hogarth. I think you touched upon it earlier, but if not, if the player plays as Big Daddy, does this mean Big Daddies will no longer be enemies in the game?
No, it absolutely does not mean that. I think Zach covered this pretty well
before.
You will fight lots of Big Daddies. There's a new Big Daddy type, at least one new Big Daddy type that is much more challenging or much more powerful than the ones in the first game to present a really good enemy. But even your run-of-the-mill Big Daddy, I mean, you're fighting somebody that's as good as yourself. So it's still pretty tough to fight a regular Big Daddy.
So, Zach, going back to you, since you seem to be a pretty good spokesperson when it comes to the puzzles and so forth, what are the puzzles and weapon upgrades going to be like in BioShock 2? Will players have a new set of puzzle challenges, and will the rewards be greater?
Well, there's sort of two parts of this question. On the weapon upgrade side, we've expanded the weapon upgrade system. There's now a third upgrade for every single weapon, and what we tried to do there was, instead of just an incremental stat increase, it actually brings totally different functionality. So the rivet gun, for example, your first two standard upgrades, you get a larger clip size, and then it does more damage. But the third upgrade adds sort of a heat element, and if you hit guys with repeated shots, it'll light them on fire. For the drill, the third upgrade actually puts kind of a big, giant magnetic coil on it, and you can reflect projectiles back at it, incoming attackers. And so the upgrades, we wanted the third one to be something that people kind of worked for, and once they got to it, it would change up their gameplay style a little bit. On the puzzle elements, you know, the BioShock 1 had things like the mini game for hacking, which is I assume what this question is referring to, and we changed the hacking system substantially to try to get it to integrate more with the core gameplay. And so from a pure sort of mind teasing puzzle aspect, it's a little simpler, but it's integrated with all the other action at once, so it's something that you have to balance between, you know, the combat that's going on at the same time.
Jordan, because of the morality system, BioShock ended differently for different players. Which of these endings are considered canon for BioShock 2?
It'd be awesome if I gave an answer which contradicted the one that I already sort of covered. Neither of them are considered canon. It is debatable among Rapture's populace, although there are several knowns which kind of allow for Tenenbaum to return and for Little Sisters to return and so forth.
So, Zach, some gamers have expressed a concern that there seems to be a feeling this game will turn out to be one giant escort mission. With such a heavy focus being on adopting the Little Sisters, what can you do to assuage those concerns?
It's really kind of no different than the Big Daddies. If you looked at a Big Daddy battle from BioShock 1 and said, is this game going to be entirely boss battles? It's an optional system. It's something that players can do or not do. We're sort of incentivizing it, obviously, with more Atom. But it's up to you when you do it. It's up to you how you tackle those challenges. And it's up to you how often you want to do it. And we've given you a lot of really cool tools to support it. But it is a completely opt-in system. And one that really each one of those gathers only really takes a minute or two. So it's the kind of thing that we hope is a diversion from kind of the main story gameplay. But if it's something you absolutely hate and never want to do, you completely ignore it. Beyond that, as everybody knows, you can't do anything to a little sister until you've defeated her big daddy. So there's no way that little sister can die and you can fail the escort mission. The only way that you can lose one of these gathers is by dying yourself.
So here's one more question for you, Zach. Then we're going to go down and go down to some multiplayer questions, and come back. So for the original BioShock, offered a few side distractions such as hacking and photography to spice up the gameplay. While BioShock 2 will have a more streamlined variation of hacking, and you've touched upon hacking already, will photography make a return? Will there be any other small elements to give some additional flavor to the game?
The photography and research system definitely makes a return, but like hacking, we sort of went out of our way to try to figure out a way to both integrate it into the core FPS combat loop and really use it as an opportunity to lure people into using some of their more complex tools. So it's now under the metaphor of a video camera, unlike the sort of still photography camera in BioShock 1. And when you tag a splicer or an enemy with this research camera, you're basically graded for a short period of time. You have 30 to 45 seconds to combat that splicer in the most creative way possible, and at the end of that time, you're rated on a standard sort of S to A scale, and you get research points based on how well you did and how creative you were in those different combinations. And then as you get research points, you eventually unlock upgrades and different perks and new tonics and things like that. But the hope is that this is something that will really encourage players to experiment with their tool set and not just sort of use the same tactics over and over and over again. And really that was the approach that we took for these kind of diversionary gameplay elements, is to not create sort of a side system, but to do something that was integrated directly into the core gameplay and was all part of one experience.
Okay, excellent. And we're going to come back to some of the single player questions, but I'm going to skip down along to where the multiplayer section is, so that way we can make sure Digital Extremes can talk a little bit about their role in the game. But first, on the multiplayer question front, I have a question for Jordan. What was the thought process behind telling the story of the Fallen Rapture in multiplayer, and why tell this story as part of BioShock 2 instead of giving us a fully fleshed out prequel?
So that's really two questions. I'll start with the prequel thing. In many ways, we feel like an honest prequel to BioShock in the single-player kind of milieu would be a very, very different game, would sacrifice a lot of what made BioShock 1 work. If it was at all honest about simulating a live city, then the chaos that sort of makes for the ecology that powered BioShock would not be possible. I'm not saying that there would never be a game that takes place earlier in Rapture, but that we certainly felt that it didn't speak directly to the values set up by the first game. As far as the multiplayer version, though, the year between 1959 and 1960 is the Civil War which tore Rapture apart, where utopia became dystopia. And I actually feel very strongly, and I think Digital Extremes would probably agree, that translating those events into multiplayer mechanics is actually extremely honest. The dog pile of self-interest could not be more laissez-faire. And so the notion that you get to compete over Adam during that time period without losing narrative integration into the BioShock world was actually really compelling for us. So it was not a difficult decision, all told.
Okay. So now actually I have some questions for Digital Extremes. We'll start with Jesse. Players can assume the role of a Big Daddy during multiplayer. How is this achieved, and what are some of the advantages to becoming Big Daddy during multiplayer?
So for most of the game modes, the Big Daddy is a pickup throughout the level. It's randomly spawned, and when you approach the Big Daddy suit, you can press a context action, then you become the Big Daddy. In some game modes, though, such as Capture the Sister, one of the team members is on the defending team in that particular game mode is randomly chosen to become the Big Daddy and defend her. In terms of advantages, I mean, the advantages are that you're a giant tank with a huge rivet gun and this big stomp ability and proximity mines, so you're a pretty whirlwind of destruction, but the disadvantage being that you don't regenerate your health, you're a much bigger target, so in some ways it's easier to take down.
So with multiplayer being added to the franchise, and with the inclusion of plasmids, how did you manage to keep multiplayer fun and balanced?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly it was a difficult thing. We stretched the balancing process out for a really long period of time just to ensure that the game had reached a steady state before we launched the title. We brought in a lot of focus groups, and we videotaped them. We watched them play through a two-way mirror. We interviewed them. You know, the focus groups really helped us identify the key areas in the balance that needed work to improve and make the game more fun.
So here's a question for Matt. What multiplayer modes are included for online play, and what is the primary focus or goals in each type?
Well, there's a bunch. Civil War, which is Team Deathmatch. Capture the Sister, which is like CTF, with the flag being replaced by Little Sister, which is pretty cool because she has a total new twist and a little bit of personality to something that is, you know, an old favorite. In addition to that, as Jesse just mentioned, there is a Big Daddy on each team. Then we have Survival of the Fittest, which is free-for-all. And Atom Grab, which is just like Oddball.
So what were the greatest challenges in developing the multiplayer aspect of BioShock 2, Jesse?
Well, I mean, outside of the technical challenges of just bringing multiplayer and networking code into a single-player engine, the main issue I think that we tackled with was making sure that the gameplay was fun, fluid, accessible, and balanced without sacrificing the look and feel of, you know, BioShock universe. You know, I remember we would do the, we were working about whether we should have a headshot sound, like when you got a guy with a headshot, and we can't really have an announcer say, headshot. So, you know, instead we made it so that the mask flew off and bounced off of geometry in the world, and that was a more BioShock way of expressing the same same experience.
So with this being BioShock's first foray into the realm of multiplayer, how tricky was it to straddle the fine line between keeping the atmosphere of the single-player mode and creating an involving, exciting multiplayer aspect to the game? Maybe Matt could feel that.
Well, it was really tricky. I mean, it was a huge challenge. The world of Rapture is so rich with you know, narrative elements and you know, the experience as a single-player. Going through that world, you're just so, there's so much to look at, so much to experience. And that really is what made Rapture in a lot of cases. So the trick was to take that and translate it into a multiplayer environment where you have, you know, many more technical issues such as, you know, 10 players and having to hit performance targets and all that type of stuff. But we worked really closely with Hoagie and everyone else over at 2K and set up some guidelines and really tried to match the visual targets and maintain all the technical and performance targets that we were trying to hit.
So here's a question for Jordan regarding challenges. What was a bigger challenge in creating BioShock 2, making sure the single-player narrative was as good as BioShock's or wrapping a narrative around BioShock 2's multiplayer?
Well, given that I work in the Marin shop, I might be slightly biased on this question, There's a guy called Danny Manley who wrote the script for the multiplayer component, and he and I could probably arm wrestle over which one had the harder job. I will say that they are very different in that in single player, story is kind of used both as direction on the ward, and it's kind of painted all over the walls, and the player has a certain amount more attention to spare for narrative. Whereas in multiplayer, your experience of these characters and of the kind of fictional themes behind it is stochastic, meaning you're exposed to it through dozens of little random interactions, and so you kind of get the sense of what the story and sort of emotional underpinnings of multiplayer are by many, many, many matches. As you play, you unlock diaries from the playable characters in multiplayer who are unique to multiplayer. And I feel like Digital Extremes would probably agree that there are lots of challenges to making story work in multiplayer to the degree that we did in Bioshock 2, but comparing them one-to-one is sort of apples and oranges.
So why was the multiplayer developed to take place before the first Bioshock, while the rest of the game takes 10 years after the events of the first game?
Well, covered this one a bit, but suffice to say that, again, you know, multiplayer, we felt like there was both some sort of lust to see Rapture pristine and new, and so the multiplayer environments are familiar from the first game, but still sort of untouched, largely, before the fall, and so that scratches kind of an itch. And on the other hand, the single-player component, we felt like it freed us up quite a bit to sort of drive the mythos of Rapture forward rather than kind of being trapped in the deterministic arc that people know occurred from the original.
So, Zach, how crucial will the critical reception of the multiplayer portion of Bioshock 2 be to your own internal goals?
Extremely crucial. It's half the game for us, and you know when we first decided to start doing multiplayer for Bioshock, it was because we thought there was something really unique about the style of gameplay that Bioshock offered and the kind of tool set that it gave players that would make something really compelling within a multiplayer space, and that Rapture was a world that multiplayer would really work well in, and so we're immensely excited to see how people receive that, since you know. There has been some controversy over it, but from early reviews that we've seen, people have been immensely pleased with how multiplayer was woven into the overall Bioshock experience, so we're excited.
So Matt, you touched upon some of the different multiplayer modes. Somebody wants to know, how many different multiplayer modes are there, and up to how many players can play at once?
We have the 7 modes, which are the ones that I mentioned before, and then team versions of a couple of those. We have 10 players max.
So how much of Bioshock's magic came from the exploratory aspects of the gameplay? Have there been any concessions made in the multiplayer to allow players to experience Rapture in new or unexpected ways?
Yeah, absolutely. I guess maybe not in the way that people would expect necessarily. In the first game, you did a lot of exploratory, you know, collecting food and you know all kinds of bits and pieces that you found around the world. In multiplayer, we don't have as much of that. There is some Adam collection and Eve collection, but really the most exploratory aspect of it is the combinations of all the plasmids that you can get. And that's really what is the most, it makes for a lot of really fun and interesting discoveries as a player.
Okay, here's some questions for Jesse. Will there be online co-op or will it be only a multiplayer?
Yeah, other than the team-based game modes such as Civil War, Capture the Sister, there's no cooperative play in Bioshock 2.
Will the multiplayer have a built-in voice chat?
Yes.
Does every multiplayer mode include a random Big Daddy spawn?
Not every mode. Some of the modes, don't really lend themselves to having a Big Daddy, such as Last Splicer Standing, Big Daddy Splicer, or Atom Grab. Doesn't really make sense to have a Big Daddy in that mode, but in other modes, such as Capture the Sister, one player is automatically picked, so it's not a Big Daddy spawn.
So what, if any, features that were initially intended for the multiplayer mode were pulled out? If so, why didn't they work?
Well, one of them that was a big feature that we planned for multiplayer but ended up removing was the Bouncer Big Daddy. I mean, outside of just being a cool guy to have in the game, he's an iconic figure for Bioshock, and we had him in and running around in multiplayer with the drill and the stomp ability, but we found that he was really susceptible to being picked off from far away, and he couldn't fend off splicers that were perching on balconies, and it actually ended up being too frustrating to play as him.
So will multiplayer be all online, or will there be an offline option?
no system link or LAN play. You can, if you want, load into the apartment or a private match by yourself if you, want to admire the scenery, but there's no multiplayer offline.
So what determines a player's rank in multiplayer? Is it solely Atom collected, or are there other, quote, experience points?
Atom is the sole element that determines your rank, but you can gather it in many different ways. There are pickups in the level, Atom vials. You can research corpses, hack a turret. All these actions will award you Atom, and that's what progresses your rank.
So multiplayer games are a dime a dozen. Do you think Bioshock 2 can compete with the juggernauts out there? What has been done to reward players and keep players playing?
I really hope so, and we think so. Outside of all the things that you unlock by progressing your rank, like the plasmids, weapon upgrades, tonics, as well as the storyline elements such as the audio diaries that you get as you progress, multiplayer is a deep game strategically. We're consistently surprised by the number of unique ways people combine plasmids or tonics in effective ways, and it should offer a lot of repeat gameplay, especially for those who appreciate depth in games.
Zach, since the multiplayer was externally developed, how often did the 2K Marin team have to consult with the external team to make sure it was up to par with the rest of the game?
Our focus with communication with Digital Extremes was more on the consistency side and sort of keeping it one, coherent experience. We had a small team of people over here that were only communicating with Digital Extremes, and that was their whole job. And then beyond that, the leads who were working directly on the single player would be brought in to review stuff and look at it. But it was something that we knew it was important to have constant communication with people within the Marin side studio, and so we were talking all the time on that.
So the original, this is a question for Matt. The original BioShock largely differentiated itself from other first-person shooters by creating a completely unique world grounded in an era that is rarely seen in gaming. How important was it to translate that level of immersion and originality into the newly added multiplayer mode?
It was extremely important. It was one of those things that we continually tried to make sure that we were doing, and really, it's such a rich world that doing multiplayer that didn't have those narrative elements, didn't have the same aesthetic elements in it or included in it, it just wouldn't feel like it was the same place. But people expected so much, and because it is such a unique environment, it was really exciting for us to be able to try and put a multiplayer type of game into that environment, because it was something that is rarely or has rarely been done. So it was really exciting for us. The other thing is that the first game really established a lot of rules, and working with 2K Marin to help us understand that stuff early on really gave us a good head start, and we're really quite excited about the fact that we were able to do it.
Here's a question for Jordan, and it's probably been touched upon a little bit already. I'm interested in how the team balanced the demand for multiplayer aspects with the demand for another top-notch single-player experience. What their top fear was going to development on what's one of the most anticipated sequels of the past 5 years?
The first part of the answer can be summarized by the other fine gentleman on this call. Obviously balancing those needs was the decision followed naturally into the decision to hire Digital Extremes and to let them make the multiplayer component their baby. Right, we feel like they've done a great job with that, and so we're kind of happy that we made that call. Splitting the focus internally at Marin would have been silly. So the sort of second part of that about our top fear, I think it's probably just the idea that originality drove the original game's success. That touring Rapture for the first time, that experiencing that kind of story for the first time, at least for much of the audience, was so novel that people were willing to overlook the fact that it was a fairly clunky shooter, the fact that the third act was a bit weaker. And so coming back to it is kind of like, okay, now we will be evaluated very honestly for our strengths and weaknesses. So we just had to make sure that our own internal quality bar was very high, and that we picked a direction that we personally felt compelling and hope to kind of pick up momentum with the fans along the way.
So here's a very subjective question for Matt. Which multiplayer mode do you think is the most entertaining?
There's clearly a lot of choices there, but I think Capture the Sister is really my favorite, only because I spent a lot of time playing CTF in days gone by. But What's really great about it is that it's the same, you know, there's elements of the same old game that everyone knows and loves, but with the little sister added in the mix, you know, there's more personality there and lots of interesting little, feedback type of scenarios that happen with her, and it just adds a dynamic element to, you know, what is a pretty standard game.
Okay, excellent. All right, so I'm going to go back to some of the single player questions. I think we've covered off on most of the thing questions people had on the multiplayer front. So we're going to delve into some of the challenges in making the game questions, and we did get a lot of these. So, Jordan, how do you approach bringing new players into the franchise while keeping BioShock players satisfied at the same time? Was it difficult to create a storyline that both new players and returning fans will understand and appreciate?
So BioShock 2 had a very obvious two-audience problem, really from its inception. We knew that there would be people who were attracted to choices we made for the sequel, but who had never played the original, and others who were hardened veterans who had possibly gone through multiple playthroughs, and for them perhaps Rapture was too familiar. And so our approach to that has really been kind of a layered one, in that the introductory levels in the game are kind of designed both to kind of make the players who know the events of the city kind of experience them afresh, in that, for example, you know, the child's eye view of Rapture is sort of the vision behind Ryan Amusements, which is a kind of propaganda theme park where the children of Rapture were kind of shocked out of ever wanting to go to the surface. But at the same time, for veteran players, that perspective, at the same time, for new players, that level serves as a crash course in Ryan's philosophy, the fall of the city, and so forth. And so we hope past the sort of Act 1 levels, we start to break very new ground, and that we'll be tickling, you know, kind of both audiences equally.
So seeing as how the original BioShock was so well received, this is a question for Zach. What was the biggest challenge in making BioShock 2?
That would be the fact that the original was so well received. in all seriousness, we had to build a team more or less from scratch. There was a really small group of people who came out here from the Irrational Studio, and so building out the team and sort of giving everyone a common knowledge of what it meant to be a BioShock and to build a BioShock was immensely challenging. And then just going up against the weight of all our own expectations, because everybody who joined this team was an immense fan of the first game, who was sort of, you know, awed and humbled to be working on a sequel to it, and there was a lot of reverence to it, which can lead to a lot of second-guessing and a lot of sort of trying to please everyone and sort of getting through that to a point where we were really striking off in a direction that felt like, you know, 2K Marin as a studio could own, and felt like it was not just following in the footsteps of what came before and not just rebelling against it irresponsibly, was just a long and difficult process for us.
Well, and here's another question. It's pretty much almost along the same lines, but for Jordan. Was it difficult to make changes and to expand upon the universe of Rapture without losing the spirit of the first game?
Yes. I mean, I think the real answer to that question is that BioShock has an extremely detailed mythos. The backstory is novel length in terms of word count in the original game, and there's a lot that was said about the events that took place there, and adding new history into that canon was certainly a challenge, and it's something that I took very seriously. The writing team in general had to become very familiar with the script of the first game, so that we weren't contradicting ourselves as we kind of brought new mystery to a city that many people had thought was just one story.
So what was the most difficult technological achievement that the team tackled, Jordan?
I think the most difficult technological achievement would probably have been the integration of multiplayer. So Digital Extremes took much of the brunt of that challenge. Outside of that, you know, there were smaller improvements, certainly significant upgrades to the AI, the inclusion of a facial animation system that allowed for those face-to-face encounters that Hoagie had been referring to previously. But really, yeah, the biggie was the inclusion of a multiplayer component in a game that simply didn't have one.
So with the, this is a good question for Hogarth. With the delayed release of the original on the PS3, how does the team feel that simultaneous multi-format development went for the sequel? Often it seems that the PS3 version tends to come out as the weakest link among such developments due to the different hardware architecture of the system. Did this pose any particular difficulties or create any issues during development?
That's a good question, and it would probably take a long time and a lot of technical details to answer it. But it is difficult to develop a game for three platforms simultaneously. I think that, you know, what we have to do is basically compromise what the strengths and weaknesses of each platform are. And the main goal that we set out with at the beginning was that we wanted the experience to basically be identical on all three platforms. We don't want to reward anybody for owning a particular platform or punish somebody for owning a different one. So, you know, it's the same game on all three platforms, and, yeah, it was tricky to get it that way.
Here's a question for both Zach and Jesse. BioShock 2 was originally slated for a 2009 release but was delayed until 2010. What are some of the improvements or changes that were able to be implemented with the extra months of development time?
I guess I'll start on that one. I mean, very few games get delayed so that you can add a whole bunch of crazy new stuff. And really, the extra time for us was really focused on balance, polish, and getting to take a good long look at the early moments of our game, really, you know, the first 2 hours, and make sure that we were providing the smoothest on-ramp for both old players and new players to the franchise, and really get a lot of testing, user testing, and polish those to a high sheen so that we could have, you know, the overall most polished experience we could offer.
On the multiplayer side, in addition to the polish, which was a huge thing that we were able to focus on at this time, we added a bunch of game modes. So about four of the game modes actually got added in that extra time, which really, I think, allowed to expand what the user will be able to experience.
So here's a question for Jordan. The world of BioShock has been heavily influenced by the work of Ayn Rand. Do any other authors stand out as clear influences in BioShock 2?
Well, there's the obvious influence of Orwell. Utopian fiction in general, and particularly dystopian fiction, almost always comes through an Orwellian filter, just because the kind of dangers of an all-consuming state are kind of best articulated by some of his stuff. That said, a lot of the other influences are nonfiction. Again, you know, sort of Dawkins and the evolutionary psychologists who follow him. The works of Marx, Mill, and you know, for example, a more modern philosopher, David Pierce, who is still alive and would like to eradicate suffering from the planet. So it's kind of a blend of fiction and non.
So do you think that the video games are an acceptable way to experience literature? And do you think you started a trend by using Ayn Rand so heavily in the first game?
So I guess I find that the term literature kind of corrupt when applied to video games. I think, you know, there are many games where the authors thereof read philosophy or are fairly versed in the classics, but didn't wear it quite so much on their sleeve. You know, kind of reading philosophy does not make you nor your work particularly deep on its own. So I do think that the demand for mature themes and the follows naturally into the demand for mature influences, and so that kind of opens us up to be a little more pointy-headed, particularly in the optional content, where players who are interested and, I guess, engaging critically with the game on an intellectual level can do so. But I wouldn't say that games are the ideal way to experience literature. I think literature has done that quite well. That said, I do think that games offer the ability to ask interesting questions and allow the player to answer them in a way that transcends previous mediums.
So here's a question for Zach. What made them keep the system where you fight bosses in the game? What made them keep the system where when you fight bosses in the game, their health doesn't regenerate even if the player dies and comes back? Doesn't this make the game easier and creates less suspense?
Yes, it does, and that's why we did not keep that system, actually. It works differently on the different difficulty levels, but as I mentioned before, one of the things we added to the Big Daddies is their little sisters can now heal them back up. This really doesn't come into play on the easy difficulty level, but on medium and then even more so on hard, they'll start refilling back to their normal health at a relatively quick rate, so that if you don't jump back in, you know, they will be back at their original strength. And that was something that we wanted to do to try to get people to really plan against those big daddy fights and make them as challenging as they deserve to be within the world. So depending on what kind of player you are, if you really want that experience where you know, you have to give a big daddy totally in one go or he's going to heal back up, you can bump the difficulty level up to hard and see what that feels like.
So will the PS3's version of the game have exclusive features, and how have you taken advantage of the system this time around as opposed to the first game? Zach?
Yeah, I mean, as Hoagie kind of mentioned with, you know, the multi-platform development, it's really our goal to offer the same exact experience across all the platforms. And so there's nothing particularly exclusive to one or the other, and whichever one you buy, you know, you're going to get the same great experience that we intended.
So, Hogarth, was there anything you learned from creating BioShock 2 that wasn't possible in the first game?
I mean, we've done a lot of things that we didn't do in the first game, you know, like environmentally being able to go outside underwater and your participation directly in the economy and the ecology of the atom economy, I should say. We used the same engine this time around because we wanted to, you know, we felt like we created Rapture in the first game. We wanted it to feel a lot like you were going back to Rapture. We did have some improvements to our shader and rendering tech that made things like the underwater fogging solution work a lot better for presenting the underwater areas. But otherwise, we've done new things, and we've developed some tech to allow us to do that. But there, you know, it wasn't like there was something that we couldn't do in the first game that we just were suddenly able to do in the new one, if that's what the question is.
So, Zach, if you could pick one one aspect of the first game that you improved on in the sequel, what would that be, and how did you improve upon it?
One of the biggest things that I think is an improvement over BioShock 1 from a gameplay perspective is actually one of the simplest. Which is just the addition of the dual wielding, of the ability to use your plasmids and weapons at the same time. And as I mentioned before, it's really transformative with the whole experience, and you no longer kind of have to modally think of, I'm going to switch to my plasmids, use electrobolt, shock the guy, switch back to my weapons, equip the wrench, and hit the guy. It's all part of just one fluid action for players, and it really just brings a whole lot more immediacy to the experience. And it was one of the first things that we added when we were still sort of working with the early BioShock toolset, and it just changed the way the game played substantially.
So, Jordan, during development, did you feel more in competition with the original BioShock's narrative, especially considering the narrative is what most people consider the most memorable aspect of the game, or the game's gameplay?
I think there were significant challenges on both fronts, in the sense that on the gameplay, you know, to be a legitimate sequel, you need to meaningfully extend those mechanics and combine them in new and interesting ways. There were also, you know, a number of criticisms of BioShock as a shooter as compared to others, and so I think Zach kind of had his work cut out for him to kind of bring us up to par. That said, on the narrative front, you kind of have to flush much of what has gone before to offer a story that is as mysterious as the original. The challenge, I guess, for us in the narrative department was kind of to meaningfully surprise people without having just said, oh, you know, all that stuff that occurred in BioShock 1, that didn't happen. we're taking it very loosely. Or to do some kind of, simple-minded reboot in the name of originality that would have pissed off, frankly, a lot of our core fans.
So, Hogarth, was it difficult to get the flooding of chambers and floating bodies to look just right?
that was pretty hard. A lot of the flooding sequences we did are just custom hand-animated and hand-treated by our effects artists to make them look just right in that particular instance. In terms of, like, floating bodies and floating stuff, that was tricky because we had to tune the buoyancy model. Our tech team actually had to tune the buoyancy model so that stuff would actually be neutrally buoyant, so it would float in one place, even after a long period of time. So yeah, it was kind of tweaky and tricky, and it's just right.
So Jordan, what was this? Jordan, was the story arc of the BioShock series predetermined before creating the first game, or was the decision to make BioShock 2 story of how you become the first big daddy made after the original released?
It was definitely not predetermined. We talked informally quite often at Irrational about different cool things that might occur in a hypothetical BioShock 2, but nobody knew how the game would be received, and so it was sort of more of a, hey, let's kind of see whether people are hungry for another BioShock, and so with the inception of 2K Marin, we started to really consider what it would mean to extend that story.
Hogarth, you have this Art Deco theme throughout the series, but what other themes did you guys actually think about when first concepting the BioShock series? Were there any thoughts on making the world Rapture more futuristic or more ancient than it is now?
I started on BioShock when production was first ramping up, so I wasn't there on the original one for the very, very beginning concept phase stuff. But I do know that the World War II kind of, not World War II, but the sort of like mid to late 40s was always supposed to be when the City of Rapture was founded since its inception. Aesthetically, however, that manifested itself originally in it being like a Nazi secret lab that was under the ocean that had like Nazis running around, and little sisters were actually these little slugs that were like kind of genetic aberrations that roamed around the halls of Rapture, and you gathered Adam from them. So yeah, it did used to be sort of like a World War II themed game with bad guy Nazis, and it obviously isn't that anymore.
So Jordan, where does the team get its inspirations for the character designs in the game? Are they based on specific archive materials from the proposed time periods in the game? How does the team determine the personalities and nature of the creepy characters featured in the title?
Well, that's a complex multi-part question. So I guess, yes, the splicers are based on reference of people with extensive disfigurement, whether from birth defects or war wounds, cosmetic surgery archives of the period. The costumes are, of course, a kind of, a cross-section of different iconic fashions of the era. Whereas something like the Big Sister, for example, is more of a literal hybrid whose motion was actually the hardest thing to get right. This sort of unstable grace we were trying to sell with her became central to her, and I guess the trauma of her existence. As far as the personalities and nature of them, we sort of have a rule of thumb that every splicer has two layers. They have a kind of the original ideal, the reason they came to Rapture, their passion, the thing that sort of obsessed them, and then they have the darker side. They have the fall from grace, which has turned them into these cursing, degenerate sort of slobs. And so walking the line between those two is something that the writers have all had to kind of become very familiar with.
So the team, the new team of who's working on the game, offers a diverse background of projects with people working on everything from Defender of the Crown to Deus Ex Invisible War. Was there anything notable from the past that influenced part of BioShock 2? Hey, Zach, you want to take this one?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting, especially, you know, when you have the challenge that we had, which is building a studio completely from scratch, from like five people up. You get a lot of diverse people who have worked on a lot of diverse projects. I mean, and some of those were called out here, but, you know, there's probably over 100 projects that people in the building have worked on at some point. And then, of course, you know, the people who helped found the studio had the great experience coming directly from Irrational Games, and so they had worked on BioShock. That obviously was a great help. But it was sort of interesting as we built out, especially on the design side, there was you know, a big affinity with people who had kind of worked on games in that lineage. We were able to work with people who worked on Deus Ex 1 and 2, you know, and Jordan worked on Thief 3, and I myself worked on a game called Project Snowblind, which was kind of a Deus Ex offshoot. And so we built up a lot of knowledge of that kind of really player-focused, open-ended action game experience, and relied on a lot of that in sort of trying to build out the more accessible and straight-up action-y parts of BioShock 2.
So since we're running out of time, I'm going to jump into some music, some audio questions, and also some plasmid questions. This is probably our most popular developer call we've ever done, so the questions are aplenty. On the music front, Jordan, the original BioShock had one of the most intense, thickest atmospheres I've personally seen in a first-person shooter. The music, the environments, the creepy children all added their touch to it. What can our gamers expect out of the BioShock 2, that will keep that motif going?
Well, I think the exploration of theme through a combination of lighting, effects, music, dialogue, and sort of I guess, constant first-person perspective, the nearly unbroken kind of nature of the storytelling is all very present in the second game. I guess, as pertains to what is new, we are selling a different philosophy this time. Sophia Lamb has a very different attitude, and her splicers are sort of deeply loyal and have kind of adopted the butterfly as a symbol of their faith. And you see a lot of that motif recur. On the kind of music side, the Gary Scheinman has returned, and he is kind of a master of taking the orchestral and the aleatoric and making them kind of live in harmony. And of course, the license tracks have returned as well, which more than probably almost any other single element helped transport people to a different period in time.
So the first one had an amazing soundtrack. What were the challenges to make this sound? Similar or better than the first one?
Well, we were very careful about enforcing the specific period, so we sort of range from the 30s to the early and to mid 50s. And I'm speaking specifically to the license track this time. I guess the challenges were to not simply repeat the formula. Now in multiplayer, we have several tracks that speak to themes of commercialism, self-interest gone wrong, and so forth. That echo the original game, and that's very deliberate. In single player, we explore kind of the perspective of the disenfranchised, the perspective of the altruist or the religious, things that would have been banned by Andrew Ryan, but in the areas informed by Sophia Lamb, these things were kind of battle flags. They were her attempts to control culture and kind of assassinate Ryan's character from the ground up.
So it's not uncommon to see a game soundtrack bundled with the special edition, but usually they're included digitally or on CD format. What was the motivation behind pressing the soundtrack on vinyl for the collector's edition? I'm not sure if the dev team had any say in this, but if not, what do you think about that choice?
Well, the original game soundtrack is already available digitally and otherwise, and so people who want the music have had access to it for some time. The collector's edition is very much a kind of BioShock aficionados package. It is something specially crafted to them for them, and it acknowledges their interest in the period. So vinyl, we felt, was a kind of more meaningful collector's item in many ways, and spoke to the exact kind of tone of the game in a way that another CD wouldn't. That said, the soundtrack for BioShock 2 is also included in the collector's edition on CD, and we've just announced that the licensed tunes are going to be available as well.
Okay, so here's some questions on the plasmid front. Zach, you can field some of these. What is the number one new plasmid that all the 2K Marin team agrees is the best?
I would actually say that there isn't one. Part of the focus of BioShock, and especially the plasmids, is doing different things for different kinds of people and how you like to play the game. And, you know, as I mentioned before, we do a lot of user testing, and we're not trying to get everybody to rate every single thing and every tool and every plasmid as their favorite, and it's a 5. It's actually good if we have some that people totally ignore and other people totally love. I mean, there are some that are definitely more divisive. I know Insect Swarm or the bees, the people who love it really, really, really love using bees. And then there are people who don't understand why you would ever use that. It's the stupidest tool in the world to them. And that kind of player choice is actually really exciting. It's the kind of thing that we're going for with the Plasmid set.
Okay. Shout out to Alyssa Finley, executive producer and beekeeper extraordinaire.
Yes.
Cool. So you filled some questions early on about plasmids, so this might cover off on some of them. But how many new plasmids have been added, and can you tell us about some of the more interesting ones in BioShock 2, and how many different combinations can you create?
Sure. Early on, our focus was not on creating a lot of totally new plasmids. BioShock 1 had a really great set. There are new plasmids both for single player and for multiplayer. On the single player side, we have a new plasmid called Scout, which sort of lets you leave your body and explore space without danger, and that was something that we specifically added because we wanted players to do that kind of observational and scout-ahead gameplay and be able to plan their combat better. And then there's another substantial new plasmid that is kind of a story spoiler, so I can't really ruin it. And then on the multiplayer side, you know, the guys at Digital Extremes got the opportunity to designed some plasmids that specifically worked in a multiplayer environment, because it's a little bit of a different challenge. I mean, for the single player side, you want plasmids that are just really fun to use on an AI, and you can sort of torture them and screw with them. Whereas for multiplayer, you need something that's both fun to have it used against you and use within multiplayer. So they have things like, you know, the Aerodash plasmid, which allows you to zip around really quickly and smack into guys, or you get to use the Houdini plasmid for the first time, so you can sort of turn invisible and teleport around, just like the Houdini slicers from the single player game. In terms of the number of combinations that they provide, it's pretty endless. We did try to design a lot of those things into the game itself, so if you have the upgraded version of Winter Blast and can freeze guys in an ice block, and you have the upgraded version of Telekinesis, you can actually pick up guys while they're frozen in an ice block, throw them at somebody else, have the ice block shatter. The shattering pieces will hit other guys, which will then freeze them, and then you can run up with your drill and smash them. And so the idea is those combinations are sort of things that we want people to discover as they play their game and as they play around with the tools that they enjoy the most.
Okay, one last plasmid question. The plasma system remains in the game from the first Bioshock. Did you feel that this was necessary to aid the player in dispatching the various enemies in addition to the main weapons? And was it ever considered that the plasmids might not work with the Big Daddy in Bioshock 2 overall?
I hate to say we never considered this, because we sort of questioned almost everything about the original Bioshock design before letting it into Bioshock 2. But we definitely did know that, you know, plasmids are such a central element of the Bioshock gameplay, and they're really what lets it expand beyond sort of the normal core shooter verb set of, you know, I damage you fast or slow or in a wide cone, and inflict kind of interesting state changes on the world, and recruit splicers to your side, or, you know, distract them or toy with them. And it was one of the challenges, early on, of figuring out how we would make a Big Daddy make sense for using plasmids, both in the sense of how it would actually look on your gloved hand and why a Big Daddy at all could use plasmids. And that's one of the other reasons why we came across the idea of having him be a prototype Big Daddy, somebody who they had been experimenting on more. And it did sort of fit with the Big Daddy fiction, because it had already been established that, you know, Big Daddies were somebody who were heavily infused with Adam, and they had been transformed by it, just like other slicers within Rapture. And that was something else that we could tie into for why a Big Daddy might actually use plasmids.
So Jordan, getting off the plasmid topic, possibly, will Bioshock 2 feature multiple endings like its predecessor?
The sort of endings are at once kind of more dynamic and more granular than the original game offered. But I think more importantly, your choices start to inform the story before the ending this time. And we feel like that offers a better ramp into it, rather than just kind of finding out, gosh, I'm Jesus or Hitler, 5 seconds before the credits roll.
Okay. What was that, clapping?
Our meeting there's another meeting going on.
Yeah.
Actually, and I hate to be the
skinny white guys with glasses.
I hate to be the splicer on this call, but we're actually out of time, and as anybody who's been on these calls before, and I know there's a number of media who are, we generally open up the end to a little open Q&A, but because we had a buggy start getting everybody on the call and had so many questions submitted, unfortunately we're not going to have that here. But if there's anything that's key or crucial that you didn't get fielded, feel free to email me and I'll try and get the developers to sign off on it, because I was lucky enough to get them for just this period of time to be on the phone. But I do want to thank everybody who participated, because I do see we have a lot of participants here, and expect an email from me following this call with some additional information. And I also want to thank all of our spokespeople for dialing in, and thanks again, everybody, and I will – the question you're all going to ask is, when do I get my copy of the game? That's also going to be going out – it's going out today or on Monday, so you'll all have your games hopefully right around the time it launches. So thanks again, everybody, and I don't know if Jordan or any of you have any parting words.
No. Have fun.
Yeah, have fun. Enjoy the game.
All right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.